Welcome to another cheese-caked episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts, Andrew, David, and Jen. This week we read Ami Kami by Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti. And now, the cast begins. All right, everybody, welcome to episode 99 of the Atomic Powered Supercast. My name's Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
And no David, because he's a very important man. He drives a Dodge Stratus, and he got pulled into a conference call with somebody in Taiwan. Not even kidding, straight up. Like, that's his excuse. I'm like, dude, Taiwan, yeah. It just sounds cool. I don't care if it's, like, boring as hell. It sounds cool.
We can't fault him for being a businessy guy.
That's true. Went with the real jobs and stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, this week we read Ami Kami, written by Justin Gray and Jimmy Palmiotti, and we actually read two series in the line. One of them was the Wonder Woman, and the second one was Batgirl. The Wonder Woman was drawn by Amanda Connor, and the Batgirl is drawn by Ted Nyfe. Nyfe? I know it's not Nyfe.
Probably Nyfe.
And this just came out this year, and it was digital release only on Comixology and the DC Comics app, which is just Comixology with a DC skin on it and a smaller catalog. What did you think of this one, Jen?
I liked it. I will say, when I started reading Wonder Woman, I opened up to that first two-page spread that shows her, you know, kind of kicking across the pages with her sword in hand, and
yeah.
I was just really struck by the art. It was so different from what we're used to, and it was just really cool, because you could see Amanda Connor's, just, like, her style integrated, like, in the line work, too, and the inking, you could see it. So, I appreciated that.
Oh, yeah, it's awesome. And in case anybody doesn't know, the Ami Kami brand came from a line of statues, right? Like, DC had taken a lot of its famous characters and rebranded them in these sort of anime style sort of statuettes and sold those. So it's like, these costume designs didn't come from these artists. So I think it's like a unique challenge to take somebody else's design from like a 3D statue and try to give it life on the page and put a character into something that's just like this lump of thing in front of you on a desk. I think it's a unique challenge.
Yeah, and I think Connor did a really admirable job with it. She kind of pulled in a lot of little details that weren't in the statue as much. Like, she makes Wonder Woman look very mature, even for a teenager, throughout all of it. Even when she's a pouty, bitchy teenager.
She's really fucking spoiled.
Yeah, oh my god, this is not the Wonder Woman we're used to at all.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like, it's the self-centeredness, you know? Like, when they're out to the battle, and she's, this is the scene that stuck with me, and she got basically grounded into her room, and Hippolyta sent a guard to go watch her, and she was complaining, like, to make sure that Wonder Woman didn't go out and join the battle.
But yeah.
She was complaining, like, why am I here? This isn't for me. I should be out on the battle. That's where I should be. And the guard was like, yeah, you're telling me. Like, I'm stuck here watching you because you're a self-centered, spoiled little brat, and you don't even realize that you're screwing me over because you're being a douche.
And then she's like, it was super douchey to just, like, whack her over the head with a shield, too.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't know. It's one thing to, like, trick someone and run away. Because she could have been like, well, I'm going to go to my room and then, you know, booked it. But no, she had to, like, knock out her friend, too.
Yeah. But at the end of the day, I like that she still is a really strong character. When she finally gets out on the field, there's a line that she says that I love. It says, let us send Hades the gift of dead men.
Yeah, that was, I don't know, she's way more violent than...
Yeah.
The traditional DC Wonder Woman as well.
And there's a lot more gore here. Like, there's a panel where she splits a guy in half with an axe. Yeah, so I don't know if this is the time to talk about it, but I'm wondering if they can be gorier, and they can have this, like, extra cheesecake. And there's a really, like, the cheesecake is powerful in this comic.
Oh, yes.
I'm wondering if they can do that because this comic book was released digital only. You know, well, if they think that you have to have some certain maturity level as a reader, or maybe that the parents can better monitor what their children are reading because they can straight up look at the catalog online and know what their kids bought. I don't know. Or maybe they just think nobody's going to read it.
Well, I think part of it is that, like, if you kind of poke around the book, there's no rating. It doesn't say teen or M or whatever the heck they actually... I don't remember DC's system for it. I only remember, like, the video game one. But it's not on here. And my guess is that it's not being forced to conform to a rating system so that they have a little more leeway with it. I don't know why they would do that, though. I mean, I certainly don't disapprove. I think it's a good move. But it's strange because they tend to be so controlling of their content in terms of what kids may or may not see.
Yeah, well, I mean, so what was your experience reading this online then? Because, I mean, we've talked about digital comics before and that sort of thing, but it was always just because we caught it online or it was the most convenient place for us at the time to get it. It was never like we had to do it online because it was only digital. But this is, I think, the first comic that we've done, other than the webcomic episodes, this is the first one we've done where it is digital only. I mean, DC has said they're going to go back and put these into print and whatever, but these are straight up right now, they're digital only. You have to have a Comixology account or a DC Comics account, which is basically Comixology, and the only way that you can interact with this comic book is through this program. I mean, did you have a good experience with the program, or...?
Yeah, I actually rather like... I use the Comixology app on my iPhone, and I do like it. I feel like it goes... It runs pretty smoothly once you know how to use it, but the layout and the framing here, interestingly, didn't seem... they were good on the phone because they kind of have, like, smaller frame... Or, like, these big frames, so, like... I guess what I'm saying is fewer frames per page, and then you can go to each of them. But I don't know if that would work out as well in, like, a traditional book. So if they're going to put it into print, I don't know how they're going to modify it. It also felt a little awkward because the proportions of the page were different than what I'm used to, and that was actually noticeable.
It was, like, portioned for a digital device.
Yeah. I mean... for instance, when it opens, we get all these really long horizontal panels with Wonder Woman fighting the Minotaurs. And we see, you know, kind of the swords and the arrows and the shields. But it's a nice close-up on the battle. It gives a nice bit of framing, but it also feels like you're missing out on the bigger picture in an almost uncomfortable way, I think.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'm gonna like geek out for a second here. Is that okay?
Go for it.
I'm asking permission to geek out on a comic book podcast. Yes, I understand the irony. So there's this idea of framing in traditional aesthetics, like an art appreciation, right? And it's the idea like the frame of the picture helps the viewer of the piece of art determine its value before they even look at it, before they even really look at the art. I mean. Like, as an example, you'd have Mona Lisa, say, right? And if you have the Mona Lisa in just a crappy wood frame versus, like, this multi-thousand-dollar gold-embroidered frame, when the viewer goes up to this piece of art, they're going to automatically have an association of the value of this work of art without ever even looking at the art, just from the frame, because you see the frame as well. And that idea extends to, like, the museum that it's in or the gallery that it's in, whether it's in a gallery or a museum, right? It goes out from there because the experience of you viewing that art is framed by there. Like, you go and you look at the Mona Lisa at the Louvre. You don't go and look at it at, you know, Works in downtown San Jose, the crappy little gallery on First Street. You know, the experience is different. And that extends all the way down to, like, the parking lot. Like, was the parking easy? Because if the parking was difficult and you're stressed, then you go into the gallery in a stressed mode and it influences the way that you view the art. And so there's this idea that, like, and it extends even further. I don't know how you want to say it, but there's the Taoist influence came in and they said that these experiences, when you come to this piece of art, they don't just influence how you view the art. They don't just influence how you see the Mona Lisa. They actually define that piece of art as much as the piece of art itself. So that they're part and parcel together. So it's not just the responsibility of the artist to draw or paint a great work of art, it's also the responsibility of the artist to make sure that that work of art is respected by the curator, respected by the city. It's your responsibility to do it the entire way down, because that experience of art, the viewer's experiencing of this piece of work, is integral to the quality of the work. And so I think that that strongly relates to comic books and digital comics. Your experience of this comic book isn't just how good is the art, how good is the writing. And I mean, we're definitely going to talk a lot about that. But it's not just those things. It's also about how you're interacting with it, how you come to it. Like, is there something that you miss in turning the pages of a comic book? Can you have more freedom trying to watch it or read it on a comic book where you couldn't necessarily read it otherwise? Like, I read this at work. I'm not going to even try to lie about that. I straight up read this at work while I was getting paid, and I could do it on my computer screen on my desktop at work. Now, I can't bust out a comic book in the office, especially one that looks like this when I open the pages, right? And I mean, that's a whole nother thing, you know? And so I don't know. What do you think about this kind of idea of, like, I don't know, it's almost like here in this instance, when you have a digital comic that's digital only, and yeah, in one sense, the curator is Comixology, right? Like, they're framing this piece of art inside their app, but it's also the reader curating it by picking what device they want to read it on. I have a phone, I have a tablet, I have a computer. I could read this on any of those. I could read this so many other places, you know? I could be out in the park, or I could be sitting in my office, and I'm the curator of my experience of this piece of art. I don't know. Is this...
So I think, yeah, it brings up a couple issues, though. I mean... So one is, like, you do definitely get the good old-fashioned argument for books that, yeah, are physical. You know, when the Kindle and the Nook
Turn
came
the
out,
page,
everyone was
smell
like,
it.
Yeah, exactly. Comic books have a smell.
Yes.
And I know, like, it's, I don't know, it's always creepy to me to talk about how things smell. But especially a comic book that you've had in your collection for a long time, like, I have comics that I have had since I was, like, 6 years old,
yeah,
right? There's nostalgia in that. And smell is actually one of the strongest invokers of memory.
The ink's different. The ink has a different smell. The paper's different. It has a different smell.
Yeah, and, like, even the way you feel a comic, like, you know, are the pages thick and glossy? And we've talked about it, too, with various, like, trades. You know, are they, like, V for Vendetta is printed on, like, this kind of really rough paper.
Yeah, crappy, thin paper.
Yeah, and then, you know, that's so unlike what we're used to, the really glossy, thick pages. So, you know, the paper, even the paper in a comic book is part of the marketing. You know, where the ad placement is. Ads appear very differently on digital media. They tend to, like, pop up or kind of, you know, push themselves into the view of your comic, especially on, like, the iPhone. And it's a different experience. On the other hand, I mean, we do have things like Read Comic Books in Public Day.
Yep.
Because it is an industry that is suffering, and we want awareness of it. So we run into issues of, are we lowering awareness? I mean, on the one hand, people are actually getting into it, and, you know, comics have become far more accessible through digital media. There's no denying it. I mean, from web comics to books that are published both in print and digitally,
mm-hmm,
people are reading digital. The thing is, it makes, I don't know, like, I prefer print. I would rather buy a trade or individual issues than buy a digital comic, because I like to, it doesn't feel like a leisure activity unless I have a book in hand. That could be because, you know, I'm an English major and, you know, spent way too much time with book in hand. But it's a different experience.
You know, I always used to say that, too. I mean, when digital comics from Comixology first came out and it first really started gaining headway in the industry, I said the same kind of thing. You know, like, I'm going to miss the experience of turning the pages. It's not going to be the same. What happens if I want to loan it to a friend? I can't do that. They have to go out and buy it for themselves. This is just a money grab. Blah, 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 blah. I made all the, you know, sort of typical arguments that people make. But now I look back on the last year and I'm realizing that the only comics that I've bought that weren't, like, specifically for this show that were individual issues, I bought them all on Comixology. Every last one. And I say that when I have two issues of Captain Marvel sitting next to me. But to be fair, I haven't read those yet. But I've read Amikami all the way up to the one that came out just this last Monday. And I'm digesting them, like, you know, 10 minutes after I buy them. And I'm really excited about it because I'm not in a location where there's a comic shop within a mile or 2 miles. I mean, I'm in sort of like, I want to say an older neighborhood. The average age is older here and the comic books are further away. So it's like, for me to get in the car, go out, pick my comics up, drive back, find time to read them, because I want to read them at home. I can't read them at the office. I could take them to work, but then I got to, you know, I got to find a place to sit and read. It's not as convenient. And there's something to be said for the convenience of digital comics that I didn't give credit to when they first started coming out.
Yeah, they're certainly convenient. On the other hand, digital comics, well, the apps that run them specifically, tend to influence readers in more than just the means of, like, their surroundings and the way they're... It deeply impacts the way they take in the media. Because, you know, I know Marvel Comic Viewer does this, and Comixology, I haven't used it on a computer, but I have used it, you know, on mobile devices.
Mm-hmm.
It has the quote-unquote smart panel view.
Yeah.
Where it guides you through the panels. And, you know, there are some comics where that honestly does not work too well. I can think of, well, I don't know, pretty much anything framed up by J.H. Williams III.
Oh, yeah.
You know, his panels just flow. They're very organic.
You could not read Batwoman the same way. You couldn't.
No. And part of the way that we read comics is we make inferences between what's happening, you know, panel to panel in the gutter. And, well, first off, Smart Panel removes the gutter. We don't have that physical space that's telling us this amount of time has passed that we translate in our brains. So, you know, it's implied, like, but it's more like a movie. You're just going and flashing images before your eyes rather than actually looking at the space between them, which is so vital. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if you're being guided as to which panel you should look at, you interpret differently because your mind is filling in different things based on which panel to panel transition you're looking at. So, I mean, on the one hand, it gives writers and artists a huge amount of control over what their readers perceive. On the other hand, maybe it allows for a little less creativity on the reader's side when reading.
Yeah, you know, there's one thing that I kept coming back to as I was reading this and thinking about how reading this digital comic is different from reading the print format and what I'm really losing out of in my experience of the work and how it's changing the work itself. Like, how my experience of reading it isn't just changing, you know, all the, like, parking lot, whatever bullshit extension of framing, but, like, how it's actually changing the work in my mind. And the one that I kept coming back to was splash pages. So most comics, the way that they'll set it up is they'll have, you know, a couple pages with tighter frames, right? Like, a couple, like, more panels on the page, and then you turn the page, and the pivotal scene just explodes in front of you. A full-page splash or a two-page spread, and it's just boom, it's right there, it's huge on the page, it gives you that nice big oh fuck moment, and it's awesome. But with a digital comic, it doesn't happen the same way because the frames scale to the size of whatever screen you're watching it on. So when you read Amikami Wonder Woman number 1, that first two frames, when they say, oh, this is the mascara, you know, when Steve Trevor is like giving his briefing, those frames are the same size on my screen as when I get to the big flash frame in Amikami. Like, it's the exact same. And so I think I lose that big, oh, fuck, moment when I read it online. And
yeah.
But the thing that also makes me come back is when you turn on the smart frames, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of guides you almost word bubble to word bubble, you know? So, like, you get that, like, tight moment where you see, like, an axe and a hand, and it's got a word bubble, and then you switch over, and you see the centaur and his word bubble, and then you switch back, and you see Wonder Woman with her word bubble, whereas before it was focused on the hand, and then you switch back to, like, a sword, you know, striking you what you now pieced together as her shield, and then when you tap it again, it pulls out and shows you the whole page, that big fight scene. It kind of feels, it reminds me of Batman Begins almost, when the screenshot, like the shots were really tight, like fist on mouth kind of thing, you know, like punch a guy here, punch a guy there, and then it pulls back and shows you him surrounded by eight dudes fighting his way through it. Like you get that tight shot, tight shot, tight shot, and then you pull back and see it all. And that was a neat experience. But I kept, when I kept seeing that, I was like, is this experience coming from Amanda Connor and Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray? Or is this experience, the way I'm reading this, coming from Comixology? Right? And some Comixology programmer deciding that this is the way you read through these frames, and then you see it all big. You know? And that's the one thing that kept sticking with me. That's what was, in my mind, that's what I kept thinking was so much different in how I'm reading this comic. As I get that, oh, fuck moment, but I don't know if I'm getting it where I'm supposed to be getting it. I don't know. Was there anything for you that kind of came that way?
Yeah, I mean, I turn off smart panels as much as I can when I read digital comics, because I don't want to be guided through. And honestly, you know how it's almost like a sitcom with a laugh track telling you, hey, this is funny. Maybe you should laugh at it. Like, I don't feel that I need the guidance, and I won't, like, I don't feel insulted. I know some people, like, feel insulted by that sort of hand-holding. Because, I mean, it's a very practical thing. How else are you supposed to look at this giant, like, high DPI, high-res image on this tiny, tiny screen? But I don't want comics to evolve into this. I will say that outright. I don't want it to be all hand-holding. I want to be able to judge whether word bubbles are like a fucking mess because they're supposed to convey that, or because, you know, the letterer was incompetent. I want to be able to make critical assessment of the material I read, whether it's comics or, you know, some big old book, whatever. And I feel like that doesn't let me have as much freedom in the way I perceive and choose to perceive, because the way that you look at a page, whether it's, you know, just a line, a big block of text, or whether it's, you know, word bubbles laid out, really changes how you're thinking about it. When I used to teach English, I would always tell my students, try to avoid making paragraphs that go on for the full page unless, like, it's a really cohesive idea. Mm-hmm. Because when a reader sees that giant block of just, you know, wall of text,
TLDR.
Like, yeah, like, ugh, I don't want to see this. And I mean, like, that's why we actually have professional letterers in the comic book industry. Mm-hmm. Because, well, of course, I'm sure that the artist has lovely handwriting. I mean, they can clearly control lines.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you want someone who is skilled in word bubble placement, in kerning, in this sort of thing. And I mean, of course, the kerning and, you know, the font comes in, but the word bubble placement, you don't get to see it as well.
Yep.
So I feel like that ended up in like a rambling mess. But basically what I'm saying is I don't ever want to be guided in how I am perceiving a page.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I think we're ready to move on to the next point. But I just want to say, because I love to get the last word, when we're talking about this, I would love to see how Comixology puts in that last issue of Hush, where you get that like full page of just, it's just like a full page splash almost of, I think it's Batman. And he's just standing in the middle of the page, and all around him, it's like a giant halo of word bubbles. As he explains what should have been two more issues worth of plot, he just explains it all to the reader in one big page, just one big fucking word vomit all over you.
Oh, yeah, that was awful.
Like, I wouldn't know how we would smart panel that page.
I'm sure they would have actually done it better, but I don't want it better, because that makes me, you know, for instance, say, ah, well, that made sense, whereas, you know, you look at it on the page there, you turn the page and you're like, go away.
Right. And like, so, you say, it changes your ability to critically assess the comic book, because they're straight up that in that instance, they would have improved it. And that goes back to, I don't know, whenever I think about somebody going back and improving something that was kind of crappy, And maybe it wasn't crappy. Maybe part of the reason some people like it is because of that. I always think of George Lucas when I think of people going back and changing art. And that's never a good association.
No.
So I think we're ready to move on to, well, in our notes it says two big discussion points. And, like, these 2 points take up a full page of notes. The other one is sort of the objectification of women.
So,
and there was, like, when these came out, there was a huge backlash for the art. And even before these comics, like, for the statuettes, there was a backlash saying that this just, like, is further continuing and emphasizing and exacerbating a problem in the comic book industry and taking what's already skimpy costumes with a lot of cheesecake and making them even worse.
Honestly didn't have a problem with it. And I think it's actually a far more complex issue than that, because this is based on anime style. Mm-hmm. So first, even aside from saying, are women being objectified here, we have to ask, well, are we, like, basically appropriating a culture? Are we taking it for our own uses and using it in a way that it was not meant to be used? And then you have to look at how manga is drawn. A lot of shonen. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Manga for boys. A lot of shonen has, like, the big, big chests, the tiny waist, the big eyes, the long necks, the hyper-feminine features.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because... Like, a couple months ago, David got me watching One Piece.
Oh,
yeah. Which is, like, a super popular manga and a super popular anime. There's, like, 550 episodes. And I noticed from episode 1 to episode 100, and I'm on, like, 380-something now, from 1 to 100, the main female character, her boobs have just kept getting bigger. And those 100, like, at first they were kind of normal, you know? It was like, okay, you know, she's kind of big-chested, but it's not, like, obscene or anything. But, like, by episode 100, it was just, like, Jesus Christ, laws of gravity, people.
Yeah. Oh man. If you ever watch Berserk, like it's the same fucking thing. And you see this throughout a lot of anime, a lot of manga. So the question is, you know, first off, are we using the manga style in an appropriate fashion? I would say, you know, whatever, it's comics. It's not like it's being mocked or anything, and there's nothing wrong with, like, borrowing.
Yeah.
But then we get into, like, well, why does manga use these proportions? Why does it feature such women? And a lot of it, as I have read, and I'm no authority on this, so nobody cite me, you know, a lot of it is an idealization of beauty, and not just beauty, but Western beauty. So, the long neck, a lot of anime characters are blonde, big blue eyes. It's the opposite of, you know, what is considered standard female Japanese appearance.
Mm-hmm.
So, manga does stem out of an unhealthy view of women in that way, and we must view it in, like, kind of that feminist scope. But then when we take it and put it in the viewpoint of Western comics, honestly, like, for Western comics, it's no worse than any, like, Rob Liefeld woman I've ever seen drawn.
Jesus.
So yeah. Yeah, it's bad, but what's the fuss?
And it's bad in a different way, and I think because it's bad in a different way, people feel the compulsion to complain in a different way and to complain all over again.
I almost feel like people, I have not honestly read any of the negative critiques of this, but if I were to imagine what people would be upset about, I'm guessing it's because Wonder Woman is sexualized in a very different way than she's normally sexualized. And we tend to see Wonder Woman as this strong, sexy, powerful female figure, but she's also maternal. She has values attached to her, like truth, tradition, peace. You know, she comes from a race of all women. There's something maternal there. Whereas this is kind of like Barbarian Queen meets, like, the cheesiest Xena episode you've ever seen. And, you know, her her breasts are far more defined. You can see, like, the lines on top, right?
Yep. Where lines, like, on perfect. Top, on the bottom, and on the side.
Yeah, they're just, like, these big honking circles. And she's curvier. She's not as muscled in a lot of the panels.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, when we're talking about costume design, I look at these and I think some of them I even like better than what's in the comic. I really like this Batgirl costume design. I really, really like it.
Oh,
when we get
God.
To Amikami Batgirl, I think it's awesome. I love the visor. Some people think the visor is stupid. I think it's cool. I think it's actually practical. You know?
I love it.
Which one do you like the best?
Duella Dent. Oh my God, so fucking cool. I saw the figurine. Yeah, I saw the figurine online and I was like, I've never read anything with this character, but I love it. So, it had an impact.
Yeah, and I think we'll talk about her more in a second when we talk about the Batgirl issues, but yeah, some of these comics just, and I mean, we didn't read the Power Girl one. I've read it because I love this Amikami thing and I love Power Girl, but I like the Amikami Power Girl outfit, which is kind of weird, and the art for that series isn't the best, but I like that outfit better than what she is right now in the New 52 with, like, the weird P symbol on her. Like, some of these costume designs aren't that bad. I mean, granted, yeah. They're designed to be, you know, specifically sold to pervy DC-loving Japanophiles, but whatever, some of them are actually pretty good.
Honestly, like, the Wonder Woman one, I think, is... I mean, okay, there have been arguments over Wonder Woman for years and years and years, right? Like, pants, no pants, heels, no heels. This is fucking amazing. First off, like, it's not actually her little breastplate with the eagle. Isn't Wonder Woman, it's just the thing that all the ladies are wearing, like, yeah. All the Amazonians. So, it's not even, like, some tacky Wonder Woman costume.
Oh, my God. I gotta say, I love that in the comic when they were, like, we need to make you wear something that combines our tradition with the tradition of the country that you're going to be going to. And what the change that they did was they made her outfit more skimpy and more like a bikini. The red, the white, the blue, and the gold was there before she was ever associated with America. And then when she became associated with America, all of a sudden had to look like a bikini.
Yeah, and
I love the implication there. I love it so much.
I like how much she hated it. She pointed out, and I think this is good writing on Paul Miatti's part, she's like, I look like a whore.
Yeah, I think her exact line, I wrote it down, is this punishment not embarrassing enough that I must also advertise myself as a whore to the nation of men? That's great writing, because that not only says that she... It not only gets the whore thing out of the way and makes you see that the character agrees with you on this part, but she says it in such this aggressive way that it's true to the character. It addresses you. That one line hits this topic from so many different angles. It's perfect. I love that line.
It's a wink and a nod to the audience because, you know, the audience is supposed to really enjoy her new outfit. Ooh. On the other hand, Palmiotti is kind of like, you know what I mean, you're a bit of a creepster for liking it. And then you kind of go, okay, well, we both acknowledge that, so it's okay, and then you stop feeling weird about it, I think.
Exactly. Yeah, and I mean, okay, I have a lot to say about pants and costume design and everything, but I just want to say I love that this version of Wonder Woman, while she is self-centered and everything, I think she's one of the stronger female characters I've read. I mean, she's self-centered and all that kind of spoiled stuff and everything, but at the same time, she's bullheaded, she's aggressive, she goes out and she's not afraid to get what she wants, she doesn't shy down from a fight ever, and the whole time when she's acting so aggressive and strong like this, what she's wearing doesn't matter a damn. Doesn't matter a single fucking thing. And I love that, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but I love that it sends the message that it doesn't matter what your character's wearing. You can write a good story no matter what they're wearing. And I think the same thing works for pants. Like, there's this whole thing about Wonder Woman and her pants. Neither one is aesthetically better or worse than the other. I mean, from some point of view, all you're doing is recoloring the legs on the page. That's really all you're doing. And so I think this is a nice... I love this comic because it's a statement. It doesn't matter what the fuck your character's wearing. You can make... You could have her out there in a fucking bikini, and she can still be a strong character, goes and gets what she wants, doesn't take shit, is the person she wants, and she's wearing a bikini because fuck you. right? Like, you don't have to... It matters, yeah, but not really. It matters because when characters are drawn in these clothes, usually they're drawn in a real misogynistic kind of way. Like,
well, they're written misogynistic,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say, sorry.
Okay.
Like, the art matters, but really, you can make the character whoever the fuck you want.
I mean, in a lot of comics, for a very long time, women were kind of second-tier people. They didn't have real thoughts or feelings. They were kind of there to support the male cast, and they tended to be replicas. You know, for Batman, there was Batgirl and Batwoman.
Mm-hmm.
For Superman, you have Supergirl. On the other hand, I mean, it's interesting. There is no Wonder Man.
True.
Right? There is no Wonder Man. You have Wonder Woman. And you can say, like, well, she's supposed to mirror Superman, but she's not really, like, part of that whole Krypton family, like,
yeah,
in any way. And while she and Superman interact closely, she has her own title. She's her own character. And that makes her interesting. And it's nice that she is who she is in this comic, if that makes any sense. She is Wonder Woman, and it's really clear.
She has a character, it's hers, she has a strong character, and her costume doesn't fucking matter. I love it so much, just for that, I love it so much. So, okay, I guess we can start actually talking about the comic now.
Yeah, man, I just want to say right off the bat, the art quality in the third issue just went really, like, ooh.
Oh, yeah.
I don't... like, noticeably worse, and I really love Amanda Connor, so I don't know if it's the digital import that did something weird there, or whatever, but it's really strikingly different than the first two issues.
Yeah, and well, I think it really works. Wonder Woman looked really, really good on the mascara, right? And she looks okay, but I think she looks out, and she looks and she feels out of place in the UN building. And she feels out of place trying to not murder Cheetah. And I don't know, maybe I'm just trying to write off an artist who I really love, but that might have been intentional, I don't know. Because the first two issues are just awesome. They're brilliant. And the third one, when she's still on the island, she's still on the island all in the third one? I don't remember.
I think that she arrived in the U.S. by...
I think so, yeah. I think she wasn't on the island all of their own, but I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Cheetah attacks at the end of the second.
That's right, yeah. I don't know. I kind of agree. There's some weird lines, but, I mean, at the end of the day, it's still good art. It's still better than a lot of what you see, and I think the first two issues are drawn so amazingly well. I love how much Amanda Connor can convey with just faces, and it improves the quality of any comic she's on exponentially, just instantly. Like, I think in the notes what I wrote is there's the scenes where, you know, Wonder Woman is fighting with Hippolyta, and there's, like, the other Amazonians in the background, and they have all these, like, awkward faces, like, oh, this is really weird, I don't want to be here. They're fighting again, this is, like, can I walk away now? And, I mean, you can get some of that through the words, but to see their faces, it gives you that feeling of what the room is like, you know? It helps you feel what they're feeling, that awkwardness. It's conveyed so instantaneously just through the faces of the background characters. I love that. That's how you use this medium to its fullest.
It's she is really talented at faces, definitely. And I mean, she is a good artist, straight up. I really like the art, except in the third issue, gotta say. But I feel like we should talk about the story, too.
Yes. Did you like
there's
it?
There's so much to say. It was okay. I really like Jimmy Palmiotti's writing. So, for me, it was kind of like average Palmiotti, which means it was better than average. But
which means it was good?
Yeah, it was good. Like, it was well written. You can see the craft in it. He's very good at dialogue and narration.
Yeah.
The plot was kind of like, okay. But I don't think that they had too much to work with. I mean, They don't really have a canon here. They have a character, and it was very strong on character. But events, three issues, that's not much to work with. So, I mean, it makes sense that we got something really small.
And the first one felt kind of short. I don't know if they all just felt kind of short because there's not ads mixed in, or I don't know, but they all felt a little bit short to me.
Well, I think that happens. I mean, this was a standard, 24-page comic, right? So,
I don't know.
Some of them are longer to read than others. You know, you run into a thing that just goes by so fast, and then other things, they take you like an hour to read.
Yeah.
There wasn't too much dialogue.
Yeah, I think maybe the reason that it's hard to get good plot from this is that I think it's clear by the end of Amikami Batgirl that Jimmy and Justin are, because I'm going to use their first names after all, it feels like they're trying to build this huge story over this whole Amikami universe, right? Like, it's all building up to something. And Wonder Woman is that slow burn introduction to the universe where, yeah, the plot's there, but it's kind of basic, and we're going to get you attached to the story through the character. And then at the end, we'll show you, what is it? We'll show you Dula Dent. And then you'll go buy Batgirl number one.
Yeah. I mean, when we saw Dent at the end, I was kind of like, oh, it's all connected. And I thought that was neat. And then Cheetah's part of their little gang. And suddenly, like, it fit in really comfortably. But until that point, it was kind of like, well, what are we doing here?
It's like,
this is neat.
Yeah, it's like, cool, origin story. Never read one of these before.
it felt a bit like filler, and I mean, if it's going to be the very beginning of a very long story arc, awesome. I just wish that it was presented more in that way, and maybe just... I don't want to say that I wanted more breadcrumbs from Palmiotti here, because I feel like that would have been leading me on too much, but... If I had read this, like, packaged as a trade with everything in it, I would have just kept on reading and breezed right through it.
So we did keep on reading past Wonder Woman. We read the Batgirl one, which, I mean, we're getting pretty deep in this podcast. We barely mentioned it. I feel like there's so much to say about these comics. What did you think of the Batgirl ones? These were drawn by Sanford Green. No, these were drawn by Ted Neife. I don't know why I said Sanford Green.
I liked the art. At first I was shocked because it was like so loose and sketchy, but I'm like, no, this works.
Wait. I was wrong. So the Batgirl ones are drawn by Sanford Green, not Ted Neife. Ted Neife did the Dula Dent one, which comes after Batgirl.
Okay.
Notes fail. Sorry, everybody.
Whoops.
Sanford Green did Batgirl. My bad. My real bad.
It happens.
So, okay. Art by Sanford Green. What do we think of this one?
I like his art. What about you?
I love it. I really did. I think that it fits the kind of visceral action, you know, like when she's fighting Poison Ivy and, like, there's the vines everywhere and, like, it felt kind of a little bit pervy because they're in the anime style and it's vines, which kind of look like tentacles, but whatever. But it's like it had this much more visceral feel. His art was more, what's the word? Not cluttered. But, like, there were more leaves. They were in a, you know, like, the park with all the leaves in the background. It felt like I was more grounded. Like, I was in that park. It wasn't some abstract location in my mind.
Yeah,
I think that really works for Batgirl, who's a much more, not much more physical, but, I mean, she's not super powered, right? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I mean, Gotham is kind of every man's city, right? It's just, like... You know, world's crime shithole, and that can be anywhere. It can be any big city.
If you have a city of 3 million people where everyone is blue collar, you've got Gotham.
I actually, after we watched The Dark Knight Rises, and my friends were saying, you know, why did everyone have to go and join Bane on his little thing? Why didn't they just say no? And I was like, well, if you've ever read a Batman comic, you would realize that Gotham is 10% ultra-rich people and police officers and 90% criminals, and there's no one else.
Yeah, pretty much.
Gotham's special. But, I don't know, you know, the art just kind of conveys this, like, hectic vibe that you get throughout all of this, that it's pulled together, but at the same time, you know, a bit, I don't want to say untamed, because that sounds cheesy, but that's kind of the right word for it.
No, and you know what, I think that's perfect, because these two girls aren't nearly as in control in their situations as Wonder Woman is. Right? Like,
yeah.
We see Wonder Woman, and it's like, you know, there's Cheetah, but you know Wonder Woman's gonna win. Fucking, of course. Cheetah, shut the fuck up. It's Wonder Woman. The only reason you're even there is because you don't know how strong she actually is. If you knew, you wouldn't be there. But in Batgirl, they're not as in control. You get this sense when, oh, fuck, all three of them are there and all three of them are awake now, and yeah, she's kind of boned. Like, you actually get that sense that they're boned because they're not... So when the art's untamed, when the art's... It's good of conveying the feeling that the characters have, and that always works out great.
Yeah. I mean, You were saying, like, how Batgirl and Robin are not safe position. Like, the scenes where Batgirl, like, gets knocked out by Poison Ivy, and Robin just starts, like, screaming. And it's not, like, a frightened scream. It's a super frustrated, like, rah! Scream. Mm-hmm. And she runs away, and it's like, wow, that was really intense.
Yeah.
And the art there works so well, where she's leaning against a tree, and it's just, like, super sketchy, and, you know, all the focus is on her. And how could you do that? How could you abandon Barbara? That was really awful. Wait, maybe she has something planned. And it's just like this hectic vibe the whole way through.
Which is how action should feel, right? Especially when you're these people.
I think this scene was actually paneled out really well for a digital comics display, because there's like two frames per page. And if you went one to the other, it's really freaking logical. There's no other way to interpret it. So, like, if you're going to draw comics for a comics app for that purpose, this is the way to do it.
Mm-hmm. So what do we think of the character, then? Do we like Batgirl as much as we liked Wonder Woman? What about Robin?
I love all iterations of Batgirl forever.
This Batgirl Robin seems like she has her shit together.
Oh, yes.
She has a mace for everything.
Right, she's like the most intelligent person in Gotham, and that's so cool, because her superpower is that she's smart.
Yeah.
It's not just that she has, like, a really good memory, because I think she has a photographic memory, right?
Which, yeah, and I think it's a good way of tying into the Barbara Gordon from the actual continuity when she was Oracle. It's like, well, she's super fucking smart, photographic memory, and she has persistent memory, whatever they call it, where she never forgets anything. She does not forget anything, and she has a photographic memory. Every bit of information she's ever seen is in her head, and she can get to it. And to see that sort of intelligence, maybe not to that degree, translated here as well, it's like, it's great crossover, because I already know who this character is and how smart she is. She's younger and less experienced, but I know her capability. It's good to have the reader be able to bring that to the page before you even read issue one. It's the same reason, like, as bad as X-Men 3 was, I love that they cast Kelsey Grammer as the Beast.
Oh, yes.
Because as soon as you hear the voice, you're like, oh, hey, it's Dr. Frazier.
Yep.
He's smart. It doesn't matter what you make his character look like. The audience is going to draw the connection that character is smart because, you know, it's Dr. Frazier.
Yep. He's nerdy and awkward, and that's, like, what that voice signifies.
Yeah. And so I like that this is kind of the same thing.
Yeah. How did we feel about Robin, though?
She was, spunkier than I think any of the male Robins were.
I'm not sure I loved it. I like the idea of a female Robin, but the whole, like, I don't know, her weird teen word choices were really off-putting to me. Because it's like, it makes me think of, I don't know, like 1960s teens, like, you know, that really ruffled my jimmies. Let's go get some malt at the pop shop. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Teenagers are awkward and annoying.
it's like, I know that she's not using 60s slang, but it still makes as little sense to me. When she's
you know, it's something I always empathize with with writers is how do you write a character in an alternate reality trying to sound cool? You know, like, as much as I love the show Batman Beyond, I hate their future slang. Fucking hate it. Like, it's so hard to write, like, future slang or fantasy slang or, like, not real world slang and have it actually come off as cool. It's
there's such a hurdle. Like, one example, and it's Frack from BSG. I know some people hate it, but it generally works. But saying, I don't know, just the way this, you know, this character, she has to show she's smart verbally. Because, you know, she tells Jim Gordon not to worry, but she says, don't succumb to anxiety. And she pulls out, like, the thesaurus every sentence. And, my God, it's unnecessary. We know Barbara Gordon's smart. And we don't even have to see it here. She doesn't use any insane vocab or weird sentence patterns. She just goes, like, okay, I think I know how to get out of here. And you know. Why can't they do that for Robin? She could be like, okay, I think I know how to get Batgirl out of, Dwella Dent's clutches. Well, and then we'll know, okay, she's prepared.
Well, because then she wouldn't be the sidekick.
Well, sidekicks are allowed to have their day in the spotlight.
Yeah, and I think she will. I think we're getting there. She went to Natasha Irons, and she said that this is happening. I put the tracker on. I did that right? Come on, that was good. This is kind of weird. Tell me this is weird. And at first, Natasha Irons, Steele is like, shut the fuck, kid. Shut the fuck up and go away. You're annoying. Basically the same thing we're saying. And then when she actually looks at the tracker, she goes, oh, hey, yeah, that is kind of weird.
Yeah.
I think she'll have her day in the sun in the next series of Amikami, the Dula Dent.
Man, speaking of Steel, there has not been a single iteration of Natasha Irons that we have read for this podcast where she hasn't been a complete fucking douchebag. Like, what is wrong with her? Why is she like this? Ugh.
Okay. Run into a teenager who's a know-it-all, who actually does know-it-all. They are insufferable. Just insufferable. Because they have that know-it-all attitude, and then on top of that, when you try to, like, quiz them to prove them wrong, they actually are smart enough to get the answer right. And it just reinforces their know-it-allness and annoys you even more. And I think that is Natasha Irons. Like, but her character down to the last bit.
Robin comes in and she's like, hey, I need help. And Natasha Irons is like, I don't have time to play tea party with you. Really? That's going to be your appropriate response there? No.
Well, I mean, she's got the hammer with the Superman logo on it, so you figure she's fighting in that league, right? And I think that's a... I mean, it's a really disrespectful welcome. It really, really is. But I think it's a good way of showing that for the actual types with superpowers or the people who can give themselves that level of power, like... I think Tea Party is a reference almost to, like, Mad Hatter, you know, or, like, whatever. It's just a crazy guy in a fucking Alice in the Wonderland costume. You can't handle your shit? Get the fuck back out there. Quit dicking around. I think it's that kind of feeling, but amped up on teenager hormones from a know-it-all 18-year-old.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, you think that a B-list sidekick comes to, you know, a big Teen Titans hero, and that hero would be helpful.
Yeah.
She's just not. Anyway, I don't like Natasha Irons.
No, yeah, and I think you would notice, like, the sidekick's coming to me. Why isn't Batgirl here? Why isn't the one who's actually worth her shit here? What happened?
Problems.
Like, it takes her a while to get to that point. She's too busy being her know-it-all teenager self to get to there.
Yeah.
But Speaking of alternate character iterations, what do we think of Jim Gordon in a wheelchair?
Weird. Not sure if want.
I mean, I get that all the heroes are women in this one, so maybe you change some backstory, but it just felt like a weird nod to make.
It felt token. Like, you know, a Batgirl comic has to have a token wheelchair character, and that's just not correct in any way.
Yeah, it can't be Professor X, so let's make a gym.
like, Jim Gordon is, that's not his character, and I don't know why they felt the need to put that in there. Like, was it to make him look frail? Because that's not a good way to use the wheelchair, you know, as a symbol. When Barbara Gordon was in it, she was a very strong character, and I think it undermines that to put Jim Gordon in it and just have him be, like, this worried old man.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought it was worth mentioning. The wheelchair is controversial these days, with it being gone in the New 52 and her having sort of rehabilitated out of the wheelchair and become Batgirl again after getting shot. Like, it's always worth mentioning, I think, when you see a wheelchair related to Barbara Gordon in one way or another. And I think sometimes it's overdone and it's too much of a nod and it's supposed to be, you know, you're supposed to read way more into it than is really there. But I think this one is just, I don't know. I think you're right. I think it felt token, and that's why it was kind of weird. So, okay, what do we think of the plot in this one? I like that at the end of this one, we're starting to get glimpses of the bigger picture. I like that 6 issues in, we're finally getting that Dula Dent is serious business.
Also, aliens.
Yeah.
What?
Aliens is good, because that means that you're going to need to bring in the heavy hitters. You're going to need to bring in the Power Girl and the Supergirl and the...
Yeah, it's just like... I mean, even Batgirl points it out, like, Dwell is way in over her head. What's she doing with aliens? What?
Yeah, somebody is here that shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Well, I think we're running kind of... My throat's getting dry. I've been talking a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot more pressure on the two of us when David's not here.
David, come back.
My throat's hurting, David. It's all your fault. So, you want to go ahead and rate these?
Let's rate it. Yeah.
All right. I'll go first.
Okay.
I'm straight up going to give these a 4.5. 4. I'm going to give them 4. I mean, I think there's some weird issues with these comics, and in not just in storytelling, but art. Sometimes there's like a little couple hiccups, but I really want to give this comic a lot of credit for coming at something that is really, really old. I mean, Wonder Woman was, what, 650 issues when they started renumbering it or something like that? And I don't fucking know how long Barbara Gordon's been around, but it's been a long fucking time. Like, these characters are not new, and it takes a lot of work and a lot of creative power to reinvent characters like this. And I think that maybe it's because it's digital, maybe because there's no rating, maybe it's because it's not even an alternate universe that DC's considering an alternate universe in their list of alternate universes. You know, maybe it's just so far off the mainstream that they're letting the writers and the artists do whatever they need to do to tell a good story. I don't know how it's working, but for me, this is a really awesome reinterpretation of old characters, and it's coming at issues entirely different ways, and it's able to do things that I don't think we'd be able to get from any other comic. Like, the whole discussion we had about fucking costuming and feminism and all that kind of crap. I mean, that's been Wonder Woman's shtick for I don't even know how long, right? How long have people been complaining about Wonder Woman's fucking costume? And there's so much great commentary and great art and writing on, not necessarily directly on that topic, but around it that you can dig into with this comic. And I mean, it's so hard to get that reinvention. And I don't know if I'm giving a 4 to this because DC's finally letting a writer and artist go buck wild on this, or if I'm giving it a 4 because the writer and artist are doing great work. I don't know, but something about this comic just makes me love it to death. I love the fuck out of these. That's why we read these. I put this on the list and I was like, we're reading this shit. I don't give a crap. It's going on the list. But yeah, I mean, talk about plot, talk about characters. I don't know, but it's so hard to get that reinvention. 4.
Okay. So, I will also say 4. I thought your original 4.5 was a little high, honestly. But, you know, your rating, whatevs. I liked this. But it's mostly for the characters and the art. I'm not quite there with the plot, and I'm glad they're doing an overarching thing, because I think it would have been really boring if it was just Wonder Woman and then just Batgirl, but the fact that it's all interconnected is interesting. I think that the digital medium provides something new and refreshing to this. I'm not sure if I like where that's going to go and where it's going to take the industry. But as it stands here, you know, the two artists, Connor and then, oh my.
Green.
Green. Sanford Green. Yes. Oops. Green. They did an admirable job framing this out so that it works well with comic reader apps. And, you know, for people who have been in an industry and been doing things a certain way for a certain amount of time, it's impressive, the flexibility that you see here and the way that they adapted these figurines into their own art style. I think I'd like to keep reading, but I would have given this a higher rating if we maybe had had it all in a trade and I had known, you know, what actually pans out with the plot, because... Well, I have to abstain from judging the plot, positive or negative, until I actually know how it resolves.
Well, I mean, I think it does say something that you're six issues in, and you're starting to get a feel for what the bigger picture might kind of be.
Yeah.
You know, I think that does say something. I mean, I understand they want to tell contained stories and have an overarching thing, but... I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe more breadcrumbs in there somewhere.
Yeah, but, I mean, overall, it's pretty enjoyable, and it definitely lends itself to being read. So, yeah, a 4.
Okay. And I think there's one other thing I want to comment on what you said, like how they did a really good job of drawing for digital media. And I think that's vital. That's a big part of why this works. It's kind of like, I'm all about the analogies today, I guess, with movies. It's kind of like 3D movies, right? You can tell the difference in quality when a movie was shot in 3D versus when it was added later. Like, the one gives you headaches and the one gives you mild headaches. All right? But, like, you can tell. You can tell the level of quality. And I think because these artists knew that they were writing for this medium, they were able to, and the writers, too, they knew that they were able to build the page for a tablet or for a phone, not necessarily for a computer, but they were able to build it for a device that kind of size. And I think that's really, really vital for why this works the way that it does. And so I'll be interested to see what this looks like in print.
Indeed.
Really. So, okay. that was episode 99, folks, which means that the next one is episode 100. One motherfucking 100. I don't even know. I don't even know how to, like, process that.
It's, like, so that. Crazy. Yeah. Like, so, wow.
So for the occasion, we're going to throw a party. Today, we're recording this Wednesday, August 29th. The party is going to be on September 7th. It's an open invite. If you're a reader, if you're a listener, and you're in the San Jose area, come on by. We're having drinks, we're having snacks, and we're going to sit and talk about comics and flick on the mic and just kind of bullshit. I mean, we'll talk about modern comics. We'll ask some of the people in the crowd, you know, kind of what they're into today. You know, ask them what they think about this, that, whatever. We're just going to sit, drink, have fun, and talk about fucking comics, because it's what we do every day. But I think the experience that makes me love comics is getting, you know, a little boozed and sitting around and bullshitting with a nice group of friends. So that's exactly what we're going to do. And since we're recording on Friday the 7th, that episode won't come out until the 8th. So you're going to have to wait a couple of extra days for your episode. But fingers crossed, it'll be worth it. Should
be
a good
one. Awesome.
It's going to be fun to get drunk and talk with, like, everybody. It's just going to be great. So if you want to sign up for that and come to the event, like I said, it's an open invitation. All you got to do is go to facebook.com/APSupercast. And click on the button that says events, and it will show our event right there. It's got a nice, like, 100 thing that I ripped off somebody's page that I found on Google Images. I don't know. Fuck them. But it's got, like, a 100. It says APSC 100 episode party or something like that. Click on that and hit RSVP. And as soon as you RSVP, I'll give you directions and an address to where to go to get your booze and your snacks and to talk about comics. It's going to be really, really fun. And then... shockingly enough, right after that is going to be episode 101, which is coincidentally our 2-year anniversary. We're going to bring on a special guest. We're going to bring in the guy that normally does the voice episode intros. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to get him to do as many lately. He's a busy, busy man. Does a lot of voice work. But if you remember, if you've been listening for a while, you know him. He's like, it's only been like a month since we've been able to use him. So we're going to have him come on. We're going to watch a comic. We don't know what. Maybe we'll pull the audience next Friday. Another good reason to try to be there. And we're going to watch a crappy old comic book movie and basically riff track it, MST3K. I don't know what the term is, but we're gonna tear that motherfucker to shreds. It's going to be fun. So that's what's coming up in the next couple weeks. Until then, you can always subscribe to us on iTunes. I know we had a little hiccup on the iTunes feed, but it's been fixed. You can go to our website, Jen, which is...
www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com.
Tons of information there. Link to the Facebook, link to what we got coming up, what we did before, all that fucking shit. You can also talk to us on the Twitters, twitter.com/APSupercast. That's at APSupercast. And... straight up, if you need more than 140 characters, just send us an email. It's atomicpoweredsupercast@gmail.com. That's like way too many ways to get a hold of us. But please, just shoot us a line. We'd like to hear anything. It's always good to talk to listeners. And lovers of comic books. It doesn't even matter. You don't even have to have listened. If you just love a comic book and want to fucking talk about comics, we are here for you. Sounds like a support group.
It kind of is.
So, yeah. Good times. I had fun talking about this one. I'm sad David wasn't able to be here, but I had a lot of fun. I love these comics.
Definitely a good read.
Yeah. All right. So hopefully we'll see a lot of you people next week at the 100th episode. Until then, everybody, goodbye.